Keywords, Volume 1, by Chan Master Sheng Yan. Chan Buddhism and its Relevance in North America, Part 1 of 2. From Chan Newsletter, Number 66, June, 1988. Spoken at the University of Toronto. I am not a native of North America, but after being in the United States for several years, I have made certain observations. People always talk about the tension and the hectic pace of life in North America, and they sometimes blame it on the high level of development of industry, commerce, science, and technology. These things have influenced our lives in ways that make it difficult not to be tense. North America is also unique as a melting pot of cultures, customs, and nationalities. Modern people are bombarded with conceptual intellectual knowledge. All the latest ideas and technology seem to pour into North America. The incessant input of new things creates confusion in our minds. It is difficult to know what to choose, what to follow. North American life is materially rich, but spiritually deprived. People feel insecure and alienated. The Chinese say, married people sleep on the same bed, but they dream different dreams. Even in tightly knit families, many people lack a feeling of security. How much more alienated do we feel among all the cultures that make up North America? I'm sorry if I seem to emphasize the negative side of North American life, but there is a positive side. If there weren't, then why would people from virtually every place on Earth long to come here to find happiness and fulfill their dreams? To millions of people in the world, North America is an ideal place. A heaven of sorts, a place with endless opportunity. Is North America the heaven many think it is? In the material sense, perhaps it is so, when compared to most other countries. But for those who already live here, how do you feel? I sense by your presence that many of you are not so sure that this place is heaven. In fact, many people think life in North America is a sort of cruel punishment from God. Although they have many diversions and luxuries, people feel God has lifted them only halfway to heaven, and they are stuck in midair, where they are blown this way and that by a constant wind of insecurity. They feel like the homeless spirits roaming aimlessly with no roots. Because they are so busy, many do not even notice the sorry state that they're in. And they live in a spiritual vacuum. They work and play at a frenetic pace day and night, but they have no real purpose. They are not masters of their own lives. Whether or not this is an accurate picture of North American life depends on your point of view. If the way I've depicted life here has an element of truth, then I think we can say Chan is needed in North America. It is often only when people realize they have problems that they need Chan. If they do not have problems, Chan is not relevant to them. And if there aren't any problems worth solving, it would be meaningless to consider the relevance of Chan in North America. What is Chan? Chan is at least three things. Chan is a spiritual practice. Chan is an ineffable type of wisdom. Chan is all phenomena. There is nothing which it is not, no place where it is not. As for spiritual practice, methods of meditation exist in Buddhism and Hinduism, as well as in other religious traditions. Although Indian gurus and Chan masters teach methods of meditation, the two traditions have different emphases. Chan Buddhism derives from Dhyana Buddhism, which began in India long before Buddhism ever entered China. Once introduced, the advanced meditation techniques of dhyana, meditative concentration, were studied and practiced avidly by the Chinese. Dhyana applies to and is an important part of the spiritual training of indigenous Indian religions, including Hinduism, the predominant religion before and after the rise of Buddhism, and Buddhism itself. The formal methods of dhyana can be thought of as yoga, and an important part of yoga is mental discipline. Chan uses concrete methods to concentrate the mind, including counting the breaths, contemplating the breath, meditating on parts of the body, focusing the mind on specific sounds, etc. The purpose is to take the mind from a scattered state, one filled with vexation and constraint, to a focused one-mindedness, and then further to where the external and internal environments become one. Vexation is caused by scattered thoughts arising from our inability to focus and concentrate the mind. Indian traditions have taught ways to emancipate people from this unsatisfactory condition through the practice of dhyana. The highest teachings of Chan do not depend on the Indian techniques of yoga and mental concentration, and indeed, go beyond them. However, for the beginning Chan practitioner, these basic methods of mental discipline are often necessary. We find instructions for such fundamental methods in the teachings of the patriarchs. In The Essential Practical Methods for Purifying the Mind, 4th Patriarch Dao Xin, 580-651 AD, recommended that you begin Chan practice by examining the mind. Sit by yourself in a quiet place. Straighten your body. Loosen your clothing so you are not restricted. Let your body and nerves and mind relax. Massage yourself several times, and allow your body and mind to come into harmony. He then describes the level of awareness you can reach using this method. First, there is the experience of inner and outer environments becoming empty and pure. You move through deepening levels of concentration to a point where even the thought of concentrating is absent. Eventually, you transcend all mental realms of experience to total unification of inner and outer environments, where all distinctions dissolve. This level is called nirvana. Another example of dhyana comes from 5th Patriarch Hongren, 602-675. In an essay called Discussing the Spiritual Practice of Cultivating the Mind, his words are similar to those of Dao Xin. He says that a beginner should practice according to the Sutra of the Meditation on Amitabha Buddha. It is a Pure Land Sutra which discusses eternal life. The teachings say to sit up straight, close your mouth, and focus your eyes in front of you. You can imagine the sun bathing you with its rays. You must learn to hold firmly to true mind, that is to say, the unmoving mind. Do not let your thoughts dwell or stagnate on any one thing. Hongren also talks about the harmonious regulation of breathing. Do not let your breathing be irregular, sometimes coarse, sometimes fine and slow, because that can cause illness. Other basic meditation methods come from a Song dynasty, 960-1279, monk named Changlu Zongzi, as well as from Zen master Dogen, 1200-1252. Founder of the Japanese Soto Zen sect. The techniques of dhyana, the Indian meditation methods that lead to samadhi, were certainly accepted and used in China. Chan is a transliteration of dhyana, but they were used primarily by beginners. If a person is experienced and has had a long history of meditation, he or she can dispense with such techniques. Chan itself is not limited to concentration. It can be realized through special methods that have nothing to do with concentration. Chan is inexplicable wisdom. Chan is ineffable wisdom. Chen cannot be expressed or described in words, nor can it be imagined or grasped by the conceptual mind. Anything that can be expressed in language, no matter how wonderful, is not Chen. The limitations of language are illustrated in an anecdote involving Master Bai Zhang Huai Hai, 720 to 1814. One day, he ascended the lecture platform in the temple and asked the monks to say something to him without using their mouths. One forward monk named Gui Shan replied, "Rather than have us speak the truth, why don't you speak it instead?" Another example of ineffable wisdom is found in the Platform Sutra, which recounts the life and teachings of Hui Neng. The fifth patriarch, Hong Ren, had given his symbolic robe and bowl to Hui Neng, signifying that he was to succeed him. Other monks vied for the robe and bowl because they viewed it as a symbol of power and prestige, rather than as a spiritual affirmation bestowed by the teacher. Master Hong Ren ordered Hui Neng to flee to the mountains to escape the wrath of those who wanted to take his robe and bowl. One of his Dharma brothers from the temple, a former army general of considerable power and will, eventually caught up with Hui Neng, who put the robe and bowl on a rock and said, "Take them. They are just symbols. What is the use of fighting?" The Dharma brother answered, "I did not come for the robe and bowl. I came for the Dharma." So Hui Neng gave his first teaching as the sixth patriarch. When he finished, Hui Neng said, "Not thinking of good and not thinking of evil, at this instant, what is your true nature?" Upon hearing this, the Dharma brother became enlightened. A third example comes from Master Bai Zhang. He said that the true wisdom of Buddha is attained only when you free yourself from all restrictions, all conceptions of good and evil, or purity and impurity, any meditative technique or other worldly method, any idea of spiritual blessings or merit. If you transcend this, you will achieve the wisdom of the Buddha. Chan is all phenomena. There is nothing that is not Chan, and there is nowhere Chan cannot be found. I said that Chan transcends all concepts, that it cannot be grasped or defined. However, Chan excludes nothing, so perhaps there are ways of suggesting Chan in speech. This example comes from Master Zhao Zhou, 778 to 897. One day, a monk studying in the temple came to Zhao Zhou and said, "I am confused. I would like the master to give me some direction." Master Zhao Zhou answered, "Have you eaten your porridge?" "Yes, I have." "Well then, go and wash your bowl." After that statement, the monk had an enlightenment experience. "Now, if after you drank milk, I told you to wash your glass, would you be enlightened?" But we must remember the background of such stories. This monk had a long period of intense practice. Because the monk's mind was straightforward and fresh, Zhao Zhou's words were enough to trigger an experience. Thus, anything we say or do can be considered to be Chan. Nothing we do is outside of Chan. In another famous story, a monk asked Zhao Zhou, "What is Chan?" Zhao Zhou replied, "When you're hungry, eat. When you're tired, sleep. When you have to shit, shit." The monk said, "Everyone knows that. Does that mean everyone has entered Chan?" Zhao Zhou asked, "When you're eating, are you doing so with a one-pointed mind? When you are sleeping, aren't you elsewhere, off in a dream?" Another monk said to Zhao Zhou, "All the multitudes of dharmas return to one. Where does the one return to?" Returning the multitudes of dharma to one refers to concentrating the scattered mind until the inner is one with the outer. It is similar to the religious concept of everything returning to God, or the question of how multiplicity and unity are related. Zhao Zhou answered, "When I was in the village, I had a cloth robe made for me that weighs 7 pounds." Zhao Zhou was asked an abstract question, and he answered with a prosaic reply, one that seemingly bore no relationship to the question. Actually, his answer was simple and direct. He had just returned from the village with a new robe, and he was happy. No matter what anyone had asked him, he would have answered, "I just had this beautiful robe made for me." You do not have to use philosophical concepts to inquire into truth. The question, if all things return to one, where does the one return to, is not really an important matter. Actually, even the most brilliant philosopher has to eat, sleep, and shit, as does the simplest of unskilled laborers. Why must the ultimate truths be limited only to the brilliant? It's not that Chen is opposed to philosophical inquiry. It's just that we don't have to use sophisticated and profound thoughts in order to seek and achieve ultimate truth. The ultimate truth is right before us and all around us all the time and every moment of our life. Another monk asked Zhao Zhou, "What is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West?" In the courtyard outside the temple, seeds were falling from a cypress tree. Zhao Zhou pointed to the tree and said, "The seeds of the cypress tree in the garden." The monk asked about the essential teachings of Chan, and he was answered with a simple, seemingly non-related reply about a tree that stood right before him. Not satisfied with the answer, the monk said, "Don't answer my serious questions by talking about the landscape." Zhao Zhou answered, "I'm not talking about the landscape." The monk then asked the same question. Zhao Zhou gave him the same answer. This is a well-known gong an in Chan. The meaning is simple. At that moment, Zhao Zhou looked out the window and saw the seeds falling from the cypress tree, so he said, "That is the real meaning of what Bodhidharma brought from the West." If Zhao Zhou had been watching an old flea-bitten dog shitting, he would have given that answer. Yet another monk asked Zhao Zhou, "What is the Buddha?" Zhao Zhou replied, "He's in the Buddha hall." The monk answered, "No, that's a clay statue." Zhao Zhou admitted, "You're right." So the monk asked again, "Then what is the Buddha?" Zhao Zhou said, "He's in the Buddha hall." If a dog had walked in front of him, he probably would have said, "The dog is the Buddha." Essentially, whatever you see, hear, sense, or do is Chan. But nothing in itself represents the whole of Chan. If you see something at a certain time, you can say that is Chan, but it will never be ultimate, permanent reality. To be continued in Chan Newsletter issue number 67.